welcome to the first edition of British Tech Comic Show. In the past, we've had June 1938, the first edition of Action Comics Superman. May 1939, the first edition of Detective Comics Batman. Today, we have the first edition of The Comic Show. And three people joining me today on Skype via all the audio-only magic. We have comic artist, iPad artist, and all-round artist, Paul Kirkle.
Hello.
Hello there, Paul.
Hello.
We have Portland-based comics fan and big hair girl supremo, Kelly.
Hi, thanks for having me on the show.
No problem.
You kind of had to because I'm the one that said, can we do a British Tech Network comic show? So thank you for putting up with me for the next however long this is.
Yeah, we all kept saying it, and then you and Paul for the masterstroke and said, now you have to do it. So we do have to do
you
it.
You have a logo, now it's a thing.
I know, it's a real thing, and it's got Spider-Man on it and everything.
And that's awesome.
Third and foremost, also in America, joining us from Colorado, is Jeff Gamut. Hello there, Jeff.
Hey, and how did I manage to get roped in also? I'm not complaining, I just don't remember how I got roped in.
You said...
Because you were on the episode when I said we should do a comic show, and you said I'm in.
You said I like
comics. Oh, I used my out loud voice again.
You did.
Uh-huh.
All right.
See where it gets you, Jeff. See where it gets you.
It gets me on comic podcasts. Yes, I keep saying where it gets me.
So this is issue one, or I suppose even issue minus one, if we...
It's issue zero.
Issue zero.
Origin story.
This is going to be collectible. This is going to be the one in the Mylar bag in the future.
That's right. We're going to have variant covers just for this episode.
Awesome.
Get out of my brain. I was just about to say that.
So we should have variant icons, but I don't know who gets polybagged.
I think we'll just go for... I'm going to go gracefully dog-eared over the years and slightly yellowing, so I don't believe in that. I've never put comics in polybags. I've always kept them and read them till they fell apart, which is why I'm poor. I don't have anything to trade on the internet anymore. So I thought, after a quick introduction, we'd just have a quick recap of what... we're doing. This is obviously the podcast going to be about comics, US comics, UK comics, not necessarily any particular genre. If it's printed in poor quality on poor quality paper, then I guess we should love it, including, you know, newspaper strips, Sunday strips and things. We'll just see where we go, you know, week from week, and see where the interesting comics leads us. So I should ask you all, probably starting with Mr. Kirkle, what's your comic thang? Where do you come at with comics? What's your big love?
My big love is Ian Gibson. I had one issue of 2000 AD, and I spent ages looking for it the other day. And it's the first comic I ever bought, which was 2000 AD, printed on loo roll and really, really ugly paper, a newsprint, and it felt brilliant. The colours were so desaturated it was untrue. You opened it up, the middle centre spread with the staples was Judge Dredd crawling through a field of glass, fire covering his body, saying, you know, I am a judge, it's my duty, I've got to keep going until I die. I thought, oh boy, that's a beautiful double page panel, I am in. And I've been reading comics ever since.
Yeah, and also creating them.
I have done a couple of comics. I haven't done as many comics as I'd like, but I've never got as much time as I'd like. I think sequential art is one of my favourite bits of forms of artwork. I kind of got into computer games because I wanted to do comics, and it was easier to get into computer games, artwork creation, than it was in comics at the time. I love comic artwork. I'm so fond of it. And whenever I listen to podcasts, they are often talking about the writer and the story and the script and whatever. And actually, I always come to comics through the artwork.
Yeah, you could live with a really awful script as long as the art is fantastic, can't you?
Oh, blimey, yeah.
And Kelly, yourself?
Well, I ended up in comics. Like, enjoying comics, I guess, accidentally, because I have a younger brother, and he's 3 years younger than I am, and at a very, very early age, someone gave him a Thor comic, or maybe he bought it like at the grocery store. We lived in a very, very small town, so there would be like a few comics on the end of the magazine rack in the grocery store. We had one, and like we had no traffic lights. It was a very, very small place, and my brother fell in love with the Thor comics and took a batting helmet and covered it in foil and built the hammer and ran around in the backyard and the whole thing. And so he would give them to me because I'm a voracious reader and I'm really indiscriminate, so I'll read whatever it is that you hand to me. Like, when I was a kid, we would visit my dad, and I was about 9, and I had read everything else that I could reach at his house, except this Tom Clancy book that was sitting on the table, so I started reading that. So I've been, like, warped forever. I'm a sucker for a Cold War spy thriller to this day, and I think that's why. But my brother started reading a lot of other comics, so he got into X-Men, and he spent, like, a lot of time in the Marvel Universe, and so I have now, by extension, because you keep loaning them to me to read, spend a lot of time in the Marvel Universe, which makes my jewelry choice kind of weird. This is something that gets me a lot of cred. At comic conventions, I wear a Green Lantern power ring that I designed, and the stone is a gamma radiated diamond.
Yes.
And so I took one look at that stone, and I said, I know exactly what that ring needs to be. And I designed it. And so now, like, if I go to some sort of nerdly event, I can go, no, look, I belong here, even though I'm a girl, and then, you know, they let me in the door.
That's kind of how we met, actually.
It is, because I had it on my hand, and it's, like, I feel like I got the design exactly right, because regular people will go, your ring is very pretty, and my people will go, that looks like a Green Lantern power ring, which I think is one with Jeff and I. And I said, yes, as a matter of fact, it is. I designed it that way. You designed it? Yeah, now ask me what the stone is. What kind of stone do you have in your Green Lantern power ring? It's a gamma radiated diamond. And he went, oh my God, I need a picture of that. And it's one of my favorite pictures of me that I have today. I stuck with comics because I like the story. And I've always been an animation nerd, and so it sort of made sense to look at comics and enjoy a graphical story as opposed to just words on a page. Like I said, I'm really indiscriminate. So I've read a wide variety of things and enjoyed a wide variety of things, whether they were popular with comic nerds or not. I'm kind of one of those people that will give everything a chance. And if I like it, great. And if not, you know, I'll move on to the next thing. There's always another comic to read. So I'm more of a story. I've gotten into a lot of graphic novels. I've been doing a lot of rereading lately. Because my library, living here in Portland, which is the main city in the area, there's a suburb of Portland called Milwaukee, and that's where Dark Horse Comics is based. And so there's a lot of Dark Horse comics in our libraries, and I'm partial to Star Wars, and Star Wars comics all come from Dark Horse, so my library has a lot of access to that stuff. So I've been rereading like Dark Empire and Dark Empire 2 and having a lot of fun with the story in some of the extended universe stuff that's happened in some of the universes that I normally like anyway. So there you go.
Cool. Excellent. And Jeff, so you're obviously connected via the real world and the mysterious gamma radiation to Kelly, so... But you've been other things.
We have a special bond.
Yes. Are you a story guy or are you a visuals guy?
I'm a story guy. But I appreciate the good visuals, but if that's all I have, then I will very quickly lose interest. So I need good stories. Mm-hmm. But yeah, when you get really great art to go along with it, then the story is enhanced in a very just wonderful, beautiful, fantastic way.
So where do you fall on the Frank Miller divide then? I mean, is that powerful story or just sort of swanky visuals searching for a place?
I think it's both.
Mm.
Yeah. The Frank Miller Batman graphic novel series, when that came out, okay, that was a totally different way for me of looking at the artwork from the Batman series. But I thought the story was really great. And then when they did the follow-up graphic novel miniseries for that, it was the same thing for me. I thought it was a very well done story, and it had artwork that while initially I probably would have thought, you know, this artwork just it doesn't fit. But it turns out it did. It really, I felt it really enhanced the story, and the artwork became part of the story.
Yeah, it was.
I prefer when Frank Miller's working in an existing universe. Like, I prefer all the Batman stuff to 300 or Sin City, which was not an existing series. That was something that he built. So, like, I prefer his Batman stuff to some of the stuff that he did on his own. I like it, but it's not like, yeah, I really need to be reading that. And I feel like I'm with Jeff on the story side. I will come down on the story side every time. There's some art in some of the Star Wars titles I've been rereading recently that really doesn't do anything for me, but the story is really interesting, and so I stick with it. And if I don't have a great story, even if the art is nice, I'll end up like flipping through it and then not spending any time. What about you, Andrew?
See, I've never been able to read a book that I haven't loved the art of. If I, you know, if you start looking at it and the artwork doesn't grab me, I will not read it. You know, and I understand that there might be some great scripting in there. There might be some lovely plot and stories and some really good character stuff. But it's like a weird thing. And some of my sort of art appreciation styles, I do like very graphic art more than I've never really gone down the road of. Or in fact, it took me a long time to get into the road of painted art. And I remember when, back in the earlier days of Slain in 2000 AD, when it started off and they had the black and white artwork that Mike McMahon provided. And who else did it? You'll have to jump in off. Glenn Fabry, yes. And then they switched to Simon Bisley.
Yep.
And, I mean, he was obviously an awesome, awesome artist. And the story didn't change. I always liked the Slain story, but for some reason, the painterly work that he produced just knocked me off the story, and a lot of that happened like with in a similar way with Zenith in 2000 AD, that, you know, Steve Yeol's original black and white graphic stuff really pulled me into the story, which then turned out to be fantastic.
You know, the black and white stuff can be very powerful. DC over the last year or so, I believe, has done a series of like Batman mini stories that are all just pen and ink, and so all black and white, and of course with Batman that starkness kind of fits really well with the personality anyhow, so that artwork really becomes part of the story, and I think it's just really well done. And yes, so you can use black and white very effectively in comics, and I can see where it would turn some people away that are all about eye candy, but if you're willing to look past just eye candy, man, you can get some fascinating stories where the art really enhances what you're reading.
I mean, I think one of my examples again was back in Slain when Mike McMahon turned in the Etch-a-Sketch artwork, which I don't know if Kelly or Jeff is familiar with, but I'm sure Paul is. Do you remember the one series that McMahon did for them?
Yeah.
Which was done with, it almost looked like it was a negative from a scraping away, do you call that, with the Etch-a-Board thing. And it was, for me, that was like almost revelatory. That was like, this is so stylized, so almost impenetrable to look at, but yet in some way it really, really picked up on the feel of the period that the story was set in and the characters and things, and it really worked. And that was like a double shock when he finished doing that and Simon Bisley picked up with those massive painted barbarian things, which was obviously in the great fantasy tradition, and it just knocked me so far sideways that it took me years and years to get back on board with it. And I must admit, as I've read more and I've gone on more, I have come more to terms with it, and I do like, you know, full colour art now. But, you know, if someone put me on that mythical desert island, and I think any of the comic strips that I took with me would be black and white ones. I don't know quite why.
The McMahon stuff is heartbreaking in a way, though, because when it was drawn for 2000 AD, they were not able to print it to the quality that it was, but they've lost all the artwork, or not all of it.
Yeah, that's tragic.
They released it recently, but they've scanned it from original copies of the comics, in some cases, because they haven't got the artwork. Whereas it was this gorgeous, thin, fine, black artwork with lines all over the place and white splodges all over the place. It lost a lot in translation. But now that they've tried to translate it up to far better printing techniques, they've lost the artwork. We can never go back. It's heartbreaking.
And he did quite literally almost kill himself doing it, didn't he?
I tell you what, I had a chat with Mick McMahon about a year ago, because I was at a comics expo in London, and I didn't get to see him, but I heard something of what he had said, and he was so self-effacing, and he was so quiet, and so unassuming about his work. I just thought, well, I tell you what, I'm going to look up his email, send him an email. If it never gets him, I don't care. So I sent him an email and said, look, you are saying that you never thought your artwork was good enough, or, you know, you were always worried about the other guys who you thought were better. Your artwork was pivotal to me. It was so beautiful and so fabulous and such a different way of looking at the world. I wanted, you know, Mike McMahon or Mick McMahon, you know, specs to see the world. And he replied back within an hour saying, that's really nice of you to say, I just never thought my artwork was good enough. I thought that was awful. And, oh, it's terrible. And he was so kind. And yet I met other artists at this Comics Expo who were far lesser artists in my eyes and who lorded about all over the place and were really rude to the public and to people that were coming up to them. And I thought, if everyone could be as good and as nice as Mick McMahon, the world would be a better place.
Yes, definitely. I'd heard that he was that kind of, you know, really nice guy and things, which is, it is really nice to find out that was somebody that was influential. I mean, when I was at school and I wanted to be a graphic designer or comic artist, him and Ian Gibson were the two that I was like, that's what I want to do for a living. And telling your teachers in sort of careers lessons, and what do you want to do? I want to be a comic artist. And I'm, right, you're an absolute lunatic. There's a whole load of banks you could work in over there in the high street. And I'm like,
yeah.
But no, I have a pen and I'm going to. And so, you know, it was, interestingly, I've never been to a school reunion, so I don't know how they would go, but, you know, it's quite nice to have gone to art college, done art, come out, been, you know, a comic artist, and then obviously I've completely changed career now, and I haven't drawn seriously for years, but, you know, to spend at least, you know, 10 years of my life making a living doing that has been fantastic. So, you sent a message there, Kelly, saying, you know, 2000 AD, obviously intrinsically British. Probably not as big or well known in the States at all.
It's not.
No. And yet you've grown up, you know, you've had in the 70s when we were digesting 2000 AD, which was all we had in that genre of comics. And other than that, it was the Beano and the Dandy and a couple, you know, I guess, was the Hornet gone by then? Stuff like that probably hadn't it?
Well, we had the Eagle.
The Eagle, yeah.
Which is kind of a precursor. We had Star-Lord. I can't remember if that was before or concurrent.
Star-Lord
was...
I actually know Star-Lord.
Was concurrent.
That was where Strontium Dog was born, and it sort of like came over when 2000 AD bought Star-Lord. They took over some of the characters.
Yeah, but I always found in the 70s that, you know, America was a much further away place in the 70s than it is now.
Right.
Yes.
And, you know, we had 2000 AD, which was an action comic with, like, Hookjaw and all that stuff in it, and Dredger. And it was all very gritty in Britain and, you know, cheap printing and gritty storylines and this sort of thing. And then, you know, my local store just had a couple of Marvel comics. It would be like Doctor Strange or Thor. Mm. And it's just like, what a different world you had with this weird stuff going on. I mean, for a start, you know, smaller, better printed comics. And you'd read those and look at this like weird magic and superpowers and stuff. And it was a bizarre world that you lived in.
And if Doctor Strange was your first introduction American comics.
Yeah.
That was quite an interesting first experience, I would have to say.
You know, looking back,
and in the 70s and 80s, it was just brilliant. You could also imagine the 70s and 80s soundtrack. Doctor Strange walks on, and it's all like 70s muted colours. He's got a Cadillac in the background and stuff like that. I had the same with Jeff, because, you know, obviously we're both... Dr. Happy Mac, we were... You go into a newsagent's and whatever, you'd see all these magazines on the thing, and you'd see two or three Marvel comics that were reprints of American Marvel comics, and they'd take, I assume, half of a comic and put three or four of them together in an anthology. But they'd last 2 or 3 months, and then they'd go bust, and they'd do a different version, and it'd be Marvel team-up, or they'd reprint it for the UK.
And you'd never find out what happened.
And you wouldn't. You'd get to, like, part 3 of a 7-parter, and it would go, well, we're sorry, there's no interest. We stop now. And you go, no, what happened? The Hulk was just
that horrible.
Spider-Man's head in.
Yeah.
And it was awful. I hated it.
I think that looking back horrible. As an adult, I'm guessing, Jeff, maybe there were some drugs taken in the creation of Doctor Strange and the production of the strip?
It would not surprise me at all. Although, the types of characters that Stan Lee envisioned, he didn't need drugs to come up with the ideas that he had. He was just that far ahead of everyone else. And so the idea of taking this doctor and turning him into some metaphysical wizard, there's no way that could have happened at DC.
No.
But with Stan Lee at Marvel, I mean, you could get stuff like that. You could get the Fantastic Four, where the only reason they ended up in costumes is because Stan was eventually pressured into putting the characters into costumes and getting away with no secret identities that just completely flew in the face of what the standard was. But yeah, I don't think that Stan needed drugs to come up with Doctor Strange, but it wouldn't surprise me if there were some drugs involved in some of the storyline creation.
Yes, yeah. I do remember Thor as well. I mean, I guess similar to Kelly's experiences with her brother's early strips, and that was also equally weird. I mean, I was looking at this, you're looking at it, flicking through it, going, but he's a god, and he's just, like, got this massive hammer, and I wasn't overly familiar with Norse mythology at that age at all. And, you know, quite obviously he is, and all of the Marvel comic heroes seem to be utterly indestructible at all times. I mean, obviously they are utterly indestructible, but, yeah, it was interesting, from a British cultural perspective, available in limited dribs and drabs, it was a very different world to the one that we sort of got on a weekly basis.
Now, if it's any consolation with getting only parts of the stories, one of the things that Marvel did in the United States with comics that I'm assuming weren't selling, they would bundle them together in 3 packs. So you get this plastic pouch that was heat sealed, so you couldn't see what the middle comic was.
Oh no!
And
but you could see what the other two were, and so you'd pick these up off the spin racks in the grocery store, and really, this is how I got into comics, because I didn't want to go down every aisle with my mom when she was grocery shopping. Yeah. So I went to the spin rack, and I'd pick out comics. And, yeah, so you'd get this pack, you'd open it up, and the middle comic was always something where it's like, the Human Fly number 3? Really? Oh my god. But then the other two would be titles that were at least somewhat well known, but it would be an issue from the middle of a storyline always. So yeah. you'd have this issue that was completely out of context, and it was very frustrating, but I could get my mom to buy those for me. Which means, instead of walking out of the store with just one comic to read for the week, I could get out with 3.
Mm-hmm. Sneaky.
Yes. Yeah. I was totally gaming the system.
And of course, they're offloading all of the unsold stock onto poor.
All those back issues of Ant-Man. Yeah.
Yeah, but I quite like those. I mean, I loved
them. So I think that was.
No, sorry. You go, okay.
Well, I was going to say something that was interesting here in comics happened in the 90s when Image Comics came on the scene and was not Marvel and was not DC and was very interested in letting people keep their work and, you know,
yes.
Not spend all your time creating all these awesome characters and then, you know, they belonged to Marvel and DC in perpetuity and now you have nothing, you know, and I don't know if there was a similar revolution over there for you guys or not, but it was something here that made, I think, a fundamental shift in the comics that were available because people were really interested in going and doing that. You know, on the upside, like, there was a lot of discussion and a whole lot of light shined on the subject of of, you know, these people work really hard on these characters and these storylines, and they get nothing. You know, if you serve at the leisure of the king, and if Stan decides you're out and you're out, then you're well and truly screwed. Like, you don't get anything from that character going forward or anything. And, you know, on the upside, it sort of made people start having these conversations. On the downside, it gave us Rob Liefeld. But, I don't have a strong opinion about him one way or another, do I? And so to me, it's something that I thought was very interesting that happened. It was sort of like what happened with desktop publishing, you know, when it sort of became a little more democratized and, you know, people sign all sorts of agreements with Dark Horse where, you know, people get to own their characters or don't or whatever it is. And I think there's been a lot of change as a result of that. And I don't know if you guys had a similar thing over there or not. Did you ever end up with, like, Image and Vertigo and all those other little houses, like, making it all the way to England?
Well, we had them. I mean, you could buy the Image comics. And obviously it was a big news event by that point because comics were like the drawn Hollywood at that point. Not as big as they are now. But even at the time, you could tell it was a big shift in publishing. I think the closest we had was 2000 AD becoming Revolver. And I seem to remember Revolver was about people owning the rights to their characters.
But it didn't last
that long.
No.
So Revolver came out of Ryan Hughes, is that right?
Yeah, that was, I think, what is it, 10 issues of Revolver? It was basically...
Yeah, it just didn't last, basically.
No, it was designed to be sort of creator-led, with all of the creators deciding what they wanted to provide to the comic and retaining all of their rights to the comic. But it did, I think it was just a little avant-garde, some of the strips, weren't they? They were for the age of the readership.
Basically, it comes down to, who are you, John Constantine or Bruce Wayne? And everyone in the UK is John Constantine. And everyone in America wants to be. I mean, it's not that they are, it's just the way that we look at the world is so diametrically different that we don't do the big optimistic splash thing. We do the down the corner of, you know, Soho, down the alleyway down there. There's a sushi bar that you can talk about, a shop next door to it that you can't talk about, and a box of release next door to that. And I think that's kind of how the UK at the time was seeing itself.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, back in the day, you know, IPC comics were famous that, you know, they owned everything in perpetuity. You got paid for the page, you delivered the page, and that was it. Which is why a lot of artists have got huge gaps in their portfolio where they haven't got their own art and they can't sell their own art and it's disappeared. And eventually that model became somewhat untenable. And I think that some of the IPC titles particularly found it, you know, very difficult to attract the new generation of British artists to them. That they were going straight to the States where they got much more control over their work and obviously, you know, more, maybe not any more money, but certainly more respect for it. And, and eventually that has changed, and obviously, you know, all the comics, the major comics in the UK now as well, you know, you create the character, you have a stake in the character, but it's taken us a lot longer to get to that stage than it did in America.
Yeah. I mean, I've just looked it up, actually. It started off by Peter Milligan, Brendan McCarthy, Grant Morrison, and Ryan Hughes. And I remember Ryan Hughes and Grant Morrison doing Dare, which is the update of Dan Dare, which is fabulous and absolutely beautifully drawn because Ryan Hughes is a hell of a graphic designer. But the fact is, why Grant Morrison, I'd completely forgotten. I think that if in the UK, if you give a UK writer a comic in the UK, possibly they're quite happier to write bleak and somber and dark and twisted. Whereas in America, I think there's possibly more of an optimistic... Possibly back then. I don't know, it's hard to describe. But I remember picking up Revolver, and it had a very twisted feel to it.
It did, yeah.
Well, do you feel that was a reflection of culture and society in that area at that time?
Well, it was the 80s, late 80s. So I think we're sort of either just coming off the cusp of Thatcher ruining the country or I don't know, either in that sort of time zone. And I think there was just a cultural feeling of misery.
Yeah, I think there was some of the
despondency and despair. And the comic artists were creatives, and creatives tend to feel the mood of a country, possibly in more of an emotional state than politicians do, who, of course, have no emotions.
There is that.
But I think it's culturally as well. I don't think that, you know, even as a child, I think in the UK, when you were a young child, you might have read The Beano and The Dandy. When I was a young child, it was, as a boy, if you didn't want the Beano or The Dandy, you had Battle and Action or Battle Picture Weekly.
Okay. I had Whizzer and Chips.
Whizzer and Chips.
Scream.
So these are all, I mean, these are all just basically sort of cheap entertainment, cheaply produced and things, and not expected to be kept, not expected to have any lasting influence on your lives. And then over in the States with Marvel and DC and the comics that you grew up with over there, I think they always more part of the mainstream culture. I mean, when way back to the early 70s, you know, comic book characters crossing over into TV, you know, and are being more part of your American mainstream culture that people grow up with and remember. And I think that's probably quite a difference to the way that the Americans have always looked at comics as being much more part of every American's life. And in the UK, we've looked at comics as being part of your life in so much as it keeps your 7-year-old child shut up for 10 minutes and then you stick it in the bin, and when they get a bit older, then they give it up and they start reading books. So it took us a
lot. I think it's gotten a lot bigger here too. I mean, in my lifetime, it's been about like this. It's been almost a hockey stick of adoption, because we would have, you know, characters on TV, but like Wonder Woman on TV was never the same as Wonder Woman in the comic, and comics, even with the comic code, comics could get away with more than what you could on TV, particularly when I was younger. And the amount of adoption of that, and the amount of people who will get an X-Men joke, is much greater now than it was 20 years ago, before they got a movie, before people went, oh, this is a universe we can take seriously. People really are telling interesting stories in this funny page sort of format, and maybe this is something we should give some credence to. And I think specifically Bryan Singer, who was the one who was really hot to do the X-Men movie and take that world seriously and turn it into something that would be fun on film, helped sort of kick that off, because a lot of people went, there's just no way an X-Men movie is going to fly, and, you know, there's too many characters and there's too much stuff happening, and, you know, you can't get into all the stuff that X-Men is into, and they did a good job of that. Every once in a while, the first couple Superman movies, those were pretty awesome, and, you know, every so often we would get a good comic book movie, air quotes, but the amount of comic, you know, thanks to Marvel specifically, because, you know, everybody remembers going to see The Avengers. Doesn't nobody remember going to see Green Lantern? That's all I'm saying.
Oh, my God. I want that 90 minutes of my life back.
All I'm saying. And
no,
you know,
but when
the
they reboot
Marvel
it, you can give them another 90.
They took their world seriously, and they built it up, and they made all these movies before they made The Avengers. And, you know, now there's another Iron Man and another Thor, and, like, all this stuff that you can put together that's really interesting because they're treating movies like they treat the comic books. You know, this character has a cameo in this series, and he shows up for a couple of issues and then bails, you know, and then in his title, you see a lot of, you know, you see that brief foray into that, and then that character is now a minor character in this guy's title, you know, and, like, the crossover and the amount of stuff that happens in the different universes, like, you see that in the movies the way they've always done it in the comics. And I think that, and, you know, watching storylines across comics, like, DC did it with Darkest Night. There was a bunch of different titles that all went into that, and, like, Crisis on Infinite Earths and all these different things that were storylines that went across a bunch of different titles, and it was really cool to get to read all of that stuff, you know, as you read it from the perspective of the character that is your favorite. So I think that stuff has been really cool, and it's part of what has made it more complicated to be a comic fan, because like, it's really common now, and there's not a lot of, it's become one of those things, like, in the time frame of the world between when George Lucas came out and said, I'm making another Star Wars movie, and people actually got to see The Phantom Menace, it was cool to be a Star Wars fan again. But before that, not so much. I got a lot of crap in my life for not being embarrassed that my favorite movie was The Empire Strikes Back. And, you know, it wasn't cool to like Star Wars in the late 80s. It wasn't cool to like Star Wars in the early 90s. And then in the mid-90s, we found out we were getting more, and then people were like, oh, yeah, yay, Star Wars. Star Wars is great. And I feel like comic books are sort of going through that same thing. And people are a lot more into it. I think also, like you were saying earlier, Andrew, the world is smaller now than it was back then. I think you guys are probably getting a lot more comic acceptance than there used to be, because like you guys got Avengers and all those other Marvel movies, and you guys got all the X-Men movies and all that kind of stuff probably, you know, went really well because it showed up over there. They're still probably weirdly American to you guys, where to me they don't seem quite so strange. But I bet that...
Well, I don't know. Last time I looked, we got Avengers before
you
did.
I bet it's happening more there too. You did.
We did, week before. Ha ha!
But I think
that doesn't mean it wasn't... It probably is weirder to you guys not being American to watch these weirdly American movies, though.
Yeah, but we've...
No?
I think culturally now we've absorbed so much Americana through TV and through film that it doesn't feel weird to be watching something with an American-centric focus.
No.
But I don't know. The Avengers was fantastic. It was lovely to see it a week before, because then we could all go on Twitter and sort of like annoy everyone we knew in America saying, I know something you don't.
I know, it wasn't fair.
But I don't know. I think the Marvel thing, the Marvel films thing, is great now. But oh boy, it was bad at one point, wasn't it? Fantastic Four was majestically bad. The Man Thing film was terrible. I don't remember the Punisher films, but I don't remember them kindly.
Oh, Punisher!
There was I remember a really bad Captain America film.
Yeah,
like the first one. It had the Red Skull in his mask looked terrible.
Okay, thank you, thank you. I watched the Captain America movie, and I'm glad that my schedule was so screwed up I couldn't see it in the theater, just like I couldn't see Green Lantern in the theater.
Mm.
So I rent the disc for $1 at Redbox. I watch it,
you got the wrong
and
one.
I'm pissed off that I spent $1 to watch that movie. I mean, I got to the end of the Captain America movie, and I'm like,
what was this all about?
The only part that I liked was seeing Nick Fury stand in the middle of Times Square, and I'm sorry if I just gave people a spoiler. Yeah, I watched the whole movie and I'm like, yeah, I don't care about this character. They have done nothing to make me like or hate Steve Rogers, and okay. my favorite character out of the whole movie was Tommy Lee Jones.
Yeah, yeah, but he's the best in any movie. I mean,
yeah.
Batman, yeah. Oh, blimey, what was it? Batman Forever? Batman Neon? Yeah. Batman Multicolor? That was awful, and the Riddler was awful, and everything about it was awful, except for Tommy Lee Jones.
Oh, yeah,
he's fabulous in everything.
Yeah, Tommy Lee Jones is awesome.
Yeah.
And yes, so I did not like the Captain America movie at all.
I thought it was fun to see Howard Stark, but that was just fun for me because...
Yeah, it was fun to see Howard Stark.
But that's it.
Yeah, and I was actually leery of going to see the Avengers movie because I knew Captain America would be in it, and Captain America is a very important character in the Avengers universe. So I'm like, what am I going to do? And I went and saw it, and I'm like, oh, great. Okay, they gave me a Captain America that I can actually like on some level now. Thank you for that. But why did you have to ruin it by throwing in this Hawkeye character?
I'm still confused about Hawkeye. Now, to be fair, okay, Captain America was certainly not as bad as the first Hulk.
Okay.
Yeah, I liked the idea of what he was trying to do with the first Hulk. I hate it. Right, this is my problem with nearly every superhero film is I would rather it stops before it gets to the third act, because the third act is always terrible. Blade, you get to the end and it's the most ridiculous Teletubby blood monster that you've ever had. I mean, that was rubbish. Which is a rubbish bit that comes out of Demolition Man, which is exactly the same as the third act of Judge Dredd. They just superimposed Wesley Snipes' face on somewhere. Which is exactly the same as all these other third act films. And I liked the Ang Lee Hulk film right up until the point where, spoiler alert for a film that's, what, 10 years old, where Bruce Banner wakes up and Thunderbolt Ross goes, right, I know you're in a delicate emotional state and you might get angry, and if you get angry, it's bad because you turn into a Hulk. So I've taken you back to the place where your mother was murdered by your father. And I'm just sitting there, open mouth, going, this is a dream sequence because nothing could be this stupid. And then it wasn't.
Yeah.
And then they follow it up with a really stupid fight with Nick Nolte. And you think, no, it, the third act in every... It's like Voyager. Star Trek Voyager is... The only way to enjoy Star Trek Voyager is to watch... Because every other episode, they all die. Yeah. And then they come back in the last 5 minutes. But if you watch every other episode of Voyager and turn it off before they come back, they all die. And it's
every
brilliant. Because they all die and they're stupid. And they're hopeless idiots. And it's cool because they all die. So if you turn it off when they all die, it's brilliant. It's a happy ending for sense. And that is writ large in every Marvel end of film ever, including the Avengers, where you have a world invasion, which is New York between Central State plus 42nd Street. That's not a world invasion, that's two roads, for crying out loud. That's three skyscrapers with Captain America standing in the middle of going, I'll stop you all out of this little funnel, for crying out loud. Just stop it with the third act.
But mind you, I mean, you said about the original... You mentioned back the original Dread film, and I think in terms of comic book films, that's got to be the biggest turnaround in quality control and movie excellence in any franchise. I mean, obviously, I guess two films in a franchise isn't a franchise, but I mean, the original, back in the day, we had to get a Dread movie made, we had to have Sylvester Stallone, he had to take his helmet off, it had to be wall-to-wall cack, and now, you know, 15 years later, comics have reached the stage where you can have a Dread movie, which is a beautiful love letter to the original comics, and still be an awesome movie.
Yeah. Although, actually, I know the original Dread movie was terrible, and it was terrible. The script was terrible. Stallone was terrible. Taking the helmet off was terrible. But it looked brilliant. Oh, the costumes didn't look brilliant, but the Angel Gang looked brilliant. Mega City
there,
1
there
looked fabulous. And the original Dread film, there is so much that is good about it. It's almost like Prometheus. If you watch Prometheus with the sound turned down, so you can't hear anyone saying anything stupid, then it's a brilliant film. As soon as you turn the volume up, it's idiocy from wall to wall. But the original Dread, to look at, is gorgeous.
This is a special gift that Pink Floyd has given us.
Hmm?
What you do when you get movies that have the great imagery like that, you shut off the audio, and you play Pink Floyd. I typically go with Dark Side of the Moon.
Except for Money. What the hell's going on that track? That doesn't deserve to be on the LP.
Yeah, well...
Money is just like... It's like Dark Side of the Moon is beautiful until you get to Money. And then after Money, you're back to beauty. That's
okay,
like the weirdest track in the world.
So here's what we do now. Just set up a playlist in iTunes that has everything except Money from that album.
We have
and
the
play
technology.
That. Yeah. And there you go. So, yeah, Pink Floyd, that fixes so many bad movies.
Mm.
Yeah, I will try that. Will reveal any hidden meaning in the Dread movie? I doubt. But it can't hurt, can it? It can't hurt.
So the new Dread movie then is worth seeing? Because I just kind of wrote it off as... I've seen a Judge Dredd movie, I don't think I need another.
No, you've seen a Sylvester Stallone movie.
Yeah, I totally blew it off.
It was in that wave of remember that movie from 15 years ago? We just did it again with better effects! And I don't care about most of those. And so I saw that movie, it had Sylvester Stallone in it next. Oh, Total Recall! I saw that movie, it had Schwarzenegger in it next.
Yeah.
And on and on and on.
I don't
and
think
so
they
I
even
didn't
really
care.
Had...
Should I care?
I think even the effects in Dread are not really even part of it. I mean, most of it's set in a couple of corridors in a derelict office block. So there really is very little in the way of effects. And some of the... I prefer the long camera shots over Mega City 1 from Dread to the original ones. I love that idea of the mega blocks sparsely dotted around the crumbling remains of what is obviously Johannesburg. And I like that one. And it's brilliant. And I love the way that in the initial sequence where Dredd's on his Lawmaster and he's chasing the bad guys... And this is like the future city, and he's chasing some guys down the road, and they're in a Volkswagen Combi because that's all they could afford. But it doesn't actually matter, you know. It's this movie has more suspension of disbelief going for it than any movie I can remember. Stuff in it that sounds like the police cars are like Ford pickup trucks because that's all that they could get.
But if they're doing a good job, you don't care.
I tell you what, Dread, the film was fabulous, but also I saw it's the first film that I've seen it in 3D and thought that was 3D done beautifully.
That was 3D.
Because it was very artistic and it was very lovely, and the whole idea that the 3D shows you the drug effect and it becomes a reason for it to be 3D was fabulous. And having seen it in 2D, it's a fabulous film. It's very good. The only problem I've got with it is the reason why I like Judge Dredd is because there is an equal amount black humour to dark violence. And I love the idea of the humorous aspect of Dredd, that you can turn around a corner and see 100 people dressed as gnomes but with sawn-off shotguns on donkeys in neon shoes or something like that, and it would fit perfectly into the Dredd universe, but it wouldn't have fitted into the film.
See, in Portland we call that Thursday.
and I remember watching at the beginning where the bad guys are turfed off the top of the 2 mile high skyscraper and fall down the central court, and they're falling in 3D slow motion. They're falling and falling and falling, and it cuts to the plaza at the bottom. And you think you know movie-making tropes, and you think, falling people, great height, they're going to hit the floor, cutaway, reaction shot to the people, no cutaway.
Yeah.
And it's that kind of like playing with your assumptions of what movie-making is, and you're waiting for the cutaway, waiting for the shock, oh my God, and it doesn't happen. You get the bodies, hit the floor.
It was a grisly 80s action thriller.
Mm.
Made with the technology of the, you know, the 2000s.
Yeah.
But it wasn't the Dredd film that I wanted, but it was a hell of a Dredd film.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think my problem, like you were talking about the third act coming apart in a lot of movies, and I think for me what I have discovered is that particularly if I was a fan of that comic series, like X-Men... And X-Men is one in particular that I read a lot of because it was one my brother really liked, and so I would read all of his. X-Men is the one example in my brain where the third film, it had a lot of things wrong with it. But I think the thing that really irritated me about it and frustrates me to this day is that I know the kind of stories that were told in the books, and I know how they dealt with things and what sort of themes they were aiming for and how all of that worked. And the part that I find frustrating is that I want it to be better. I know there are better stories in there than what you've told. And I know that the story that you chose to tell was handled better in the books. Why couldn't you stick a little closer to the books because of the way that they did it? I always described the third X-Men film as double-spaced because, like, every time there was an explosion, you had to see it from three different angles. And, you know, there was only about half a movie in that movie's worth of time, really. And I wanted more plot. I wanted more stuff to happen, not explode. And so, like, my frustration with some of those, like Captain America had more character development in Avengers, where he was one of several characters, than he did in his own entire movie. And yes, I want him to be better. Like, I want that to be a better story. I want that to be more fun. I know they had to do a lot of setup because origin story and all of that for people who don't know any better and people who are told by their comic nerd family member, you know, who was probably telling them while they were fixing their email, you should go see the Captain America movie because there's going to be an Avengers movie and you need to see this one in order for that one to make sense. And so a lot of people went and saw it and felt like they were obligated. And my problem with it was it was not my favorite, but, I just wanted it to be better. I've read some good Captain America books. I've read some good books from everybody that was in the Avengers, and I just want some of the stuff that I really liked and some of the things that really stuck with me to carry forward into the movies, and that didn't happen.
So is that, you would describe that as Kelly's first law of movies, is it? happening is not exploding.
Yeah, I like things happening versus things exploding. That's
exploding is not happening. Or,
well, just because it exploded doesn't mean I need to see it explode three more times from three different angles. And yeah. And you know, an explosion in itself is usually not a plot point. And while we're at it, Kelly's second law of movies is if you're going to have an action sequence, you need that action sequence to be not 5 solid minutes. Of half-second cuts between action, 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 action. I have ADD, and I can't keep up with Transformers. Okay? This needs to stop. If you're going to spend that kind of money on those kind of effects, give me a second to look at them. Thank you.
Kelly, here's how I fixed that. I stopped watching the Avengers, or the Transformers movies. I saw the first one, and was like, well, glad I had a few drinks before I saw that one, and never saw any of the others. It totally fixed
that
the problem right there.
You know, the only reason
I find that there's a lot of frenetic pacing in stuff, like, it doesn't make it, if you're having a world end, well, okay, to use Paul's example, if you're having a world-ending battle on two streets in New York, give me a second. Let me look. Let me see what it is that's coming around the corner. You know, there's already tension. There's already drama. This is the world. Remember these two streets in New York? They're the whole world, and they've been invaded. And let me see it. You know, the fact that you chop, 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 and skip from cut to cut to cut to cut to cut of these action sequences doesn't make it any more exciting. And anybody who's already invested in it, by the time you get to the point where everything's dropping from the sky and trying to take over two streets in New York, that's the world. They're not going to care that there weren't more cuts in the fight scenes.
No.
You know, the problem I had with the world is being ended and is a fight scene at the end of Avengers. Where is there when it's so Fantastic Four show up and help? Why didn't Spider-Man show up and help? Why didn't all these other superheroes that live in New York City show up when giant robot space worms started coming out of the sky?
Contractual obligations. They weren't allowed to. Fox said no. They were going to come out. They were trying to get out of it. And a Fox lawyer said, don't you dare go out of your apartment, Peter Parker. You belong
to
us.
I mean, you know, I can't imagine Wolverine just sitting around when a giant space worm flies out of the sky.
No.
I mean, first
he'll
check
drunk,
what he's
sure.
drinking. Yeah, I mean, he'll be drunk, and he'll check what he's drinking, go, no, not absinthe. All right, so it must be really coming out of the sky. Let's go screw some stuff up.
Yeah. Of course, you realize, Jeff, that the only reason that...
Yeah, one thing I really liked about the Avengers universe movies is that they get together, but... Like, I liked that they had the cameos in the other ones, but I don't like the same thing that I don't like about the comic books is that there's a lot of forsaking of all the other universes.
Listen, guys, I think that Skype is probably beginning to have a go with.
They're onto us.
So I thought what we'd do after what was a fantastic round robin discussion there, which I found really enjoyable, thanks ever so much, is just have a quickly go around and just try and get a quick from each of you one thing, cool comic thing that people that listen to this might want to rush off and read and buy that kind of encapsulates where you are. So, Paul?
What is good at the moment? I'll tell you what, Invincible up to issue 100 was my favourite comic of the modern age. I thought Invincible was fabulous. And 1 to 99 is brilliant. 100 was a total letdown for me. But and I was really, really sad about that. And it's really weird, because DC 52 has been a complete corporate jumping-off point for me. Marvel now, to be honest, I've jumped off completely. I've been going back to some of the old indies, and I'm loving it. Joe Sacco with Palestine and Footnotes from Gaza is brilliant. David Peterson with Mouse Guard is fabulous. But the comic that I come back to every Christmas, and I sit, when it comes to Christmas, I do Christmas Eve, Christmas Day, and I've done it with loads of all the family. Christmas Day, when all the kids have gone to sleep, I sit down with a large glass of whiskey and read as much Cerebus the Art of Arc as I can until I want to go to sleep. I love Cerebus. I think it's the most artistically beautiful comic, and I don't... The politics of it, I'm not interested in it, but in the same way that sometimes we look back at comics and we say it's a product of its time, and it's there are issues and gender issues or racial issues that are product of its time. Cerebus, the issues that it brings up are part of the story. I'm not saying I'm agreeing with it, but the story was majestic. And I think Cerebus issue 1 to 300, I can't think of a better comic or personally work of literature, fully rounded work of literature at all. And if you can start with Cerebus, I would either Jacka's story or Melmoth. Either are beautiful, and they are self-contained stories. I can't think of anything better in the comics world that has ever been created.
So you're a fan then?
Oh, I love it. Love it.
Kelly?
I'm going to pick Sandman by Neil Gaiman. There's a number of editions of them out. You can always pick up something. You don't have to go buy like 37 comics in order to get to read the series. You can check them out of libraries. It's one that's a very common novel, graphic novel, at least in the United States, so a lot of libraries have it. I like, this is one of the times where I spend probably at least as long, if not longer, looking at the art on the page as I do reading the words on the page and figuring out what plot's going on here and why would he say that and what would make her do that thing. And I really like it as a story, and I think it's one of those where if you don't read comic books, I would tell you to read this comic book. And there aren't very many that I feel like I can recommend because they're good storytelling and not just a good comic, and Sandman is one of those, so that's what I pick.
Cool, excellent. And Jeff?
Man, two hard acts to follow. Wow. Okay. I'm going a little retro with my recommendation. During the 1970s, there was the short-lived sci-fi series Space 1999.
Yes.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Uh-huh. Good start.
And as it turns out, a group of people got together and created a miniseries called Space 1999 Aftershock and Awe. And this is I think it's like five or six issues. And what it does is it looks at Breakaway Day from Space 1999. So for people that don't know what that means, that's the day, what was it, September 19th or September 24th, 1999, when the Earth is, or when the Moon is blown out of Earth's orbit through a nuclear waste accident. This series looks at what's happening leading right up to, so the days right before Breakaway Day, and then it focuses on what happens on Earth. So you get a little bit of what's happening on Moonbase Alpha, but then you get a lot of what's happening, what's happening on Earth, events that helped lead up to the nuclear detonation on the Moon, and what happens with the survivors on Earth after the Moon is gone. And I think it's really well done.
Excellent. So, I do remember that from that did actually, the old memory cells did fire off there as soon as you said that. So And I'm impressed that you were... Were you pulling the date of the moon out of your own head, or was it the big exo head of Google?
No, it's actually coming right out of my own head.
Of course, that is a big...
Did I get the exact day?
I don't know. I haven't checked, but I'm impressed. So impressed, I don't want to know if you're wrong. You're right. Even if you're wrong, you're right.
If I'm wrong, I'm off by less than a week, I believe.
It's a reimagining. If Jeff's wrong, then we change the story.
That totally works for me. He sounded like he meant it, so I'm good with that. That's all I really did.
Yeah, there you go.
Well, my one is a Dark Horse comic from Kelly's homeland.
Yeah,
I'm not going to go for Halo Jones.
Ah, I'm sure you were. I was convinced.
No. I've done that to death. Yes, obviously, my default position is Halo Jones. But having said about my initial distrust of the fully painted artwork, this is a full colour comic, but it's done by an artist who originally was more famous for his black and white artwork.
Joe, bye.
Next part. Dark Horse miniseries called The Light and Darkness War by...
Oh, yeah, of course, Kennedy.
Kennedy and Tom Vitch.
Who did Dark Empire.
Yes, that's right. Mm. And it's a fantastic... Yeah. I mean, talking about sort of graphic input and story input, it's the two of them for me together. I mean, it's a brilliant story. You know, wounded Vietnam War helicopter pilot slips into a coma and is transported to an alternate reality where all of his colleagues who died in the helicopter crash have picked sides in an endless war. And it's kind of like, you know, there's various characters from history. Leonardo da Vinci's in there, Nikola Tesla's in there, creating, you know, war-winning inventions against each other. But the graphic power of... I mean, I don't think Cam Kennedy's ever drawn anything better. It's really nice. It's a quick in, 6 episodes and out again. And I think it was very early for Dark Horse in their publishing career. I think it was one of their earlier releases. But it's there's not a lot about it on the internet. And there are quite a few issues available on US eBay. Nothing really on the UK. But yes. And Kelly's got a bonus kick for us.
Well, I'd like to put in a bonus pick because this is someone that I know. I'm totally going to be upfront about my bias. This is a friend of mine here in Portland who had this good idea for a comic book and has made it into a reality. It's on its 4th issue now. It's called La Brujeria. I put a link in the show notes. And this is black and white, and the art is fun. And the stories are great, and it's set here in Portland, so every once in a while there'll be a nice little background piece of like, hey, I've been there, hey, I got really drunk there one time, etc. And it's super fun to read. It's a little supernatural. It's very, very cool, and I like it a lot. And you can buy both physical copy. There's digital copies available. I believe they're available worldwide. I don't remember. I know Aaron was working on that, and I don't know if it actually happened or not. But La Brujeria from Geek in the City Comics, and Aaron Duran is the guy I know who works on it, and it's a lot of fun to read, so you guys should check it out.
Excellent. And the fact that it's a personal recommendation, you know the author, even better.
I've met the artist, and he's also loved this. Drew a picture of me at Stumptown Comic Fest last year, and he's a lovely fellow. I just haven't hung out with him as much as I hung out with Aaron. So
cool, excellent. Well, good picks, everyone. I think that's excellent. And I'm going to, before my Skype really dives in us, I've got 2 things left to do. One is to mention British Tech Network's ever forgiving and ever generous sponsors, UK2. Who provide all the bandwidth for you and shows. Obviously, the comic show is going to be a teeny tiny fraction of the bandwidth that the other shows are chewing through. But hopefully we'll grow, and UK2 will grow with us, because they do seem to be very committed to the network. Visit the website, uk2.net. Put in the offer codes, get the discounts, and that's also not just the bandwidth, they're also giving people discounts back. So jolly good show, chaps, and I know Ewan's proud to have them, I think they've done the network well proud as sponsors.
They're lovely.
Excellent. Jeff, where can people find you?
Well, when I'm not talking about comics, you can find me at macobserver.com, writing about Apple and other technology things. You can find me on Twitter and app.net. I'm Jay Gamut, both places. And when I'm hanging out at coffee shops, I write about the stupid things I see there. And that's at freshbrewedtales.com. So this was fun. We need to do this again.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, definitely.
Yep. Kelly, whereabouts are you? Apart from the orange
room. You can find me on Twitter and app.net as Verso. And you can also find me on the unofficial Apple weblog at tuaw.com. And I am also occasionally appearing elsewhere on this network on the British Tech Network Mac Show.
Paul.
You can find me all over the place, but if you search for Kercal, which is kercal.co.uk, that'll get you to the Flickr and the Twitter and all the blog's down and has been down for a week, which is really annoying. But it'll get you to the rest of it. Oh, sorry, can I do a pick? I've just remembered something.
Go.
Really quick pick of the week.
Quick.
There's an app called Halftone, which I love. It's a really gorgeous comic photo picture generator, and they've just created Halftone 2, which is out. I only noticed it as pick of the week this week on the App Store. If you want to make comic-y type things from photos or whatever on your iPhone, it's a brilliant app. I think it was free. I can't remember. I think it was free. It's a really nice photo artwork app creator. I love it.
Awesome. Halftone. Brilliant.
Yeah.
We'll try and dig that up and put it in the show.
1.0 is cool.
Excellent. Mm.
And you can find me, Andrew. I'm Dr. Happy Mac. I'm also normally on the Mac Show. You can find me at Dr. Happy Mac on Twitter and app.net. And if you put Dr. Happy Mac into Google, all hell breaks loose. So that's a win. I want to say thanks.
What you're saying is Andrew is your secret identity?
Andrew, this is my non... Yeah, the mask's off now. This is weird. We're doing a comic show and this is not my alter ego. This is my actual ego. But then apparently I was listening that's Superman, is it not? Superman is his real identity. Clark Kent is his secret identity.
Oh, well, that's only Quentin Tarantino talking. Yeah. What's he know?
Yes, exactly. What's he done for comics? Anyway,
he learned to write them, I bet.
Thank you ever so much to Kelly, to Jeff, to Paul. I think for a first issue, we done good.
Yes.
We all lived through it, so that's a big plus.
All the
next issue, somebody has to die. Is that what happens in this issue?
No one show up wearing a red shirt, just saying.
No. And we're hopefully avoiding third act frenzy as well, so that's brilliant. Cool. Well done. I'm going to press the stop recording button, and Ewan, our overlord and master, will do the music and things on that. So I'm sure there's a button for this.